The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the Harvard Health Letter of April 2025. And the first article is entitled, New Thinking on Important Blood Tests. Don't be surprised if your doctor has a few changes in store for your routine blood work. Some tests might be added or subtracted from your lab order this year, or your doctor might talk about interpreting the results a little differently. Here are several tests to discuss with your doctor. Vitamin D is important for many aspects of health, including calcium absorption, healthy bones, inflammation reduction, and immune function. Doctors debate how much vitamin D we need, and most guidelines say we don't have enough evidence to support routine screening in healthy people. Yet many doctors still regularly order the tests. The test measures a type of vitamin D called 25-hydroxyvitamin D. Until recently, levels considered healthy or sufficient varied widely, ranging from 12.5 nanograms per milliliter to 60 nanograms per milliliter. Several guidelines recommended levels above 20 or 30 nanograms per milliliter. The Endocrine Society, one of the main organizations that steers vitamin D practices, published a new vitamin D guideline in their August 2024 issue of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. In a major shift, the guidelines ditched the concept of vitamin D sufficiency and deficiency and strongly recommended against routine vitamin D testing. The exception is for people with specific conditions like chronic kidney disease or difficulty absorbing vitamin D like Crohn's disease. The recommendations are based on a lack of evidence for routine testing benefit. The Endocrine Society guidelines also say that most healthy adults don't need vitamin D supplements, exceptions including pregnant women, people with prediabetes, and people age 75 or older. These groups may benefit from low-dose vitamin D supplementation of 1,000 international units per day, but it should also try to get the vitamin through fortified foods or incidental sun exposure. So what should you do? Well, you should talk to your doctor about the new guidelines. If you have a condition that causes vitamin D deficiency, fall into one of the above groups, or take a medication that can lower vitamin D levels, you might need periodic screenings. Otherwise, it's unlikely that you need to be routinely tested or take a supplement. Most of us get enough D from foods like fish, fortified dairy products, and fortified cereals. And the body can make vitamin D in the skin from just 10 to 15 minutes of sun exposure a few times per week, says Dr. Joanne Manson, Harvard's leading vitamin D researcher and chief of the Division of Preventive Medicine at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. If you're concerned that you're not getting enough, vitamin D, it's safe to take a supplement of 1,000 to 2,000 international units daily. But our large randomized trials of vitamin D suggest that most people already get the vitamin D they need, and supplements have limited benefits. What about blood tests to detect heart disease? You're probably familiar with a routine cholesterol test that measures various fats in the blood, like the bad LDL cholesterol, that can increase your risk of heart disease and stroke. This year, your doctor might also order two additional blood tests. One measures lipoprotein A, or LPA. If LPA levels are very high, your risk of heart attack, stroke, and some heart valve problems can increase, even if standard cholesterol levels are normal. High LPA is inherited, which means you only need to have it measured once, as currently recommended by the National Lipid Association. The test is covered by insurance, but few people get it, primarily because we didn't have treatments to lower LPA until recently. The other test measures C-reactive protein, a substance the liver makes when there's inflammation in the body. Results of the test, called a high-sensitivity C-reactive protein test, can indicate inflammation levels as well as heart attack or stroke risk. The test is covered by Medicare. It's not always routinely ordered, but it is endorsed by the American Heart Association to help predict heart attack risk. A Harvard study published August 31, 2024, in the New England Journal of Medicine suggested that LDL, hsCRP, and LPA tests might predict stroke and heart problems decades in advance. The research involved 28,000 women, average age 54, followed for up to 30 years, whose levels of LDL, CRP, and LPA were measured at the start of the study. All three biomarkers were linked to heart attack and stroke risk, especially CRP. Risk increased even further for people who had high levels on two or even three of the different tests. What you should do. Everyone, regardless of gender, should have all three of these measured together, preferably in your 30s or 40s, since prevention needs to start early, says Dr. Paul Ridker, the study's lead author and director of the Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. If your doctor hasn't yet ordered these tests for you, ask about them. As some of this information is new to primary care physicians, many patients are bringing the research paper with them to their office visits. Beyond lifestyle changes, your doctor may recommend specific treatments based on your test results. The next subject is a complete blood count. A CBC looks at components of blood that indicate if you have various conditions, like anemia, infection, and blood cancers. The routine test measures the amount and characteristics of red blood cells, five types of white blood cells, platelets, and hemoglobin, a protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen, and calculates such values as hematocrit, the percentage of blood made of red blood cells. Results for each measurement are compared against a standardized normal range. For example, a red blood cell count between 4 and 5.4 million cells per microliter is considered normal for women, and 4.5 to 6.1 million per microliter is normal for men. Ranges can vary slightly by lab. A result outside the normal range is considered abnormal. A Harvard study published online December 11, 2024 by Nature suggests that it may be more useful to compare your latest CBC results to your previous numbers rather than to standard reference points. Scientists evaluated the CBCs of more than 12,000 healthy people who had five tests over 20 years. Participants' results didn't change much, regardless of where the numbers fell within the normal range. Each person had a unique combination of set points. Researchers say changes in these set points might help doctors catch health problems earlier, which is important for conditions like diabetes or heart disease. Normal ranges are too broad and should be narrowed for each person. That interval might be lower for some people and higher for others, says Dr. John Higgins, the study's senior author and a pathologist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Another finding from the study is that participants whose set points fell into the lowermost or uppermost end of the measurement's normal range had higher rates of disease diagnosis and death within 10 years, compared with people whose set points stayed in the middle of the normal range. What you should do. Keep an eye on your CBC results, learn what's normal for you, and talk to your doctor if you see changes. Bring this article if you feel it will help. Set points give you a personalized benchmark to detect slight deviations from your steady state and help us interpret other diagnostic test results for a more accurate picture of health. Now here's a segment from the Ask the Doctor section of the Harvard Health Letter. It's written by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief. Question. I've often tried to start a regular exercise program, but after a few weeks, I step on the scale and I haven't lost any weight. So what's the point? Many of my patients have asked me that question over the years. As we report on page 8, how much aerobic exercise does it take to lose weight? It takes consistent exercise to lose weight, but that's not the main benefit of exercise. Studies from Harvard and elsewhere have documented scores of other benefits. Regular exercise reduces your risk of the most common causes of premature death: heart disease, stroke, and many types of cancer, including cancer of the breast, lung, colon, esophagus, prostate, pancreas, liver, kidney, bladder, or endometrium, as well as myeloma and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that's just for openers. Regular exercise also reduces your risk of dementia, diabetes, depression, and anxiety. It improves your energy level, reduces the level of any chronic pain you might have, greatly improves the quality of your sleep, and even protects you against constipation. Regular exercise strengthens the lungs, reduces your risk of getting pneumonia from infections, and reduces your risk of dying from pneumonia. Particularly in women, exercise reduces the risk of developing osteoporosis and the risk of fractures of the hip and other bones. It also decreases the likelihood that you will develop gallstones or kidney failure. Finally, believe it or not, regular exercise seems to reduce a person's risk of developing addictive behaviors, like smoking, alcohol abuse, and drug abuse, and makes quitting those addictions more likely to be successful. So please don't think the only reason to exercise is weight loss. In fact, if you don't also control your calories, it's hard to lose weight just by exercising. That's because burning calories by exercising is harder than adding calories by eating. Moderate exercise burns about 400 to 500 calories an hour. So 2 hours of moderate exercise would burn 1,000 calories, about the number of calories that are in a Big Mac meal. Does it take 2 hours to eat a Big Mac meal? Nature designed the human body to be physically active. Yes, our bodies are not what they were when we were 20, but they still benefit enormously from regular exercise. And they let us know that by making us feel good from consistent workouts. No pill ever invented, or likely to be invented, can give you as many health benefits as regular exercise. It doesn't have to be vigorous activity, just brisk walking for 150 minutes per week. You don't have to break a sweat. It doesn't cost a dime. Don't give up on it. Now here's another useful article from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's entitled, How to Stop Stressing Over Minor Memory Lapses. Everybody knows about senior moments, episodes of momentary forgetfulness about things like someone's name or where you parked the car. You might not fret about these cognitive hiccups if they're infrequent, but what if you're constantly forgetting little details? The stress of worrying about memory loss can be taxing and make your thinking skills even fuzzier. When you're stressed, your focus is pulled off the task you're working on, and you may begin thinking or worrying about the stressor. This can decrease mental clarity and make it harder to focus, making mild memory lapses more prominent, says Dr. Stephanie Buss, a cognitive neurologist and director of the Memory Disorders A2Z Clinic at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. It's natural to be concerned about memory loss. This can stem from seeing family members or friends who've received a diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment, or it might come from noticing cognitive changes over time, Dr. Buss says. That doesn't mean your thinking skills are faltering. Small memory lapses can be normal with aging. This includes things like forgetting someone's name briefly, or walking into a room and momentarily forgetting why you walked in. We worry more about large memory lapses, like forgetting parts of conversations, or recent or upcoming events, changes in the ability to speak or understand, or changes in focus or organization that affect your day-to-day life. Any decline in your ability to do complex tasks like managing medicines, working, driving, cooking, or managing finances would also be cause for concern, Dr. Buss says. A healthy lifestyle is essential for handling stress of any kind and for maintaining brain health as we age. Physical activity is one of the most important factors in a healthy lifestyle. It promotes healthy cognitive aging, reduces stress, and helps with sleep and mood. Dr. Buss says, we also strongly recommend that you stay socially engaged, connecting with friends and family regularly. Cognitive activities like reading, puzzles, games, or listening to music also are vital for maintaining brain health, and are especially powerful when paired with social activities. Sleep is also key to brain health. You need a full night's sleep to help the brain cement information into memories and flush away waste associated with Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Buss advises prioritizing sleep hygiene and maintaining a consistent bedtime. You should also eat a healthy diet, stop smoking, and get underlying conditions, especially high blood pressure, under control. Managing stress will also help your brain. Meditation, yoga, tai chi, deep breathing exercises, and mindfulness can trigger the relaxation response, the opposite of the stress response. Treating any associated anxiety and depression can help too. It can improve focus, sleep, and your motivation to engage in healthy lifestyle activities, Dr. Buss says. You might also feel less concerned about memory lapses by using practical strategies to retain information. For example, when you meet a new person, use their name in conversation right away, Dr. Buss suggests. Also, keep a single central calendar and refer to it regularly. That's easier than keeping information in multiple places. Always place your keys or glasses in a designated spot. Take your medication at the same time every day, and use notebooks, address books, and other tools to organize and store information for fast retrieval, rather than relying entirely on your memory. Feel free to bring up concerns to your doctor, who can help you figure out what's normal and what requires more investigation, Dr. Buss says. Consider involving loved ones in these discussions. Perhaps they've noticed memory lapses you're unaware of. But don't wait if you're worried. It's possible that you just need a quick memory screening and a talk with your doctor about lifestyle factors to improve your memory. If you'd like more information, check out the Harvard Special Health Report, Improving Memory. Now, here's another useful article entitled, Should You Take Pills or Use Patches for Pain Relief? We all want effective pain remedies, and pills and patches are common options. Both are available with prescription or non-prescription active ingredients. But which is best to relieve discomfort, a pill or a patch? Pain pills and pain patches deliver medications in different ways. When you take a pain pill, its active ingredient is absorbed through the gastrointestinal tract, broken down in the liver, and sent to the bloodstream for quick distribution throughout the body. Patches are placed on the skin. The active ingredients work locally and they are absorbed in the bloodstream more slowly and to a lesser degree than the active ingredients in pain pills. Pain pills and patches have their own sets of potential problems. Pain pills might be hard to swallow. They may not be absorbed very well due to digestive health or diet issues. They might interact with another drug being processed in the liver, causing dangerously high or low levels of either drug. They might cause gastrointestinal side effects like nausea, ulcers, or stomach bleeding, depending on the drug. In contrast, pain patches are slower to start working, which isn't ideal for acute pain. They might cause skin irritation at the site where you apply it. They might not be available with the active ingredient you need. There are, of course, also benefits. For example, because pain patches work slowly, they provide a steady stream of medication over an extended period. That can be helpful for chronic pain or long-term recovery from an injury. Patches are also convenient for people with swallowing difficulties or those who have a hard time remembering to take pills. And because patches are absorbed through the skin, you avoid the gastrointestinal side effects and potential interactions, says Dr. Sanjeet Narang, a pain medicine specialist and director of the Arnold Warfield Pain Center at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. In contrast, pain pills work quickly. That's important if you need rapid relief of your pain, like a sudden pounding headache or a backache from doing too much yard work. For rapid relief, an over-the-counter pain pill like acetaminophen, Tylenol, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, Advil, or Motrin is the best approach. Following surgery, or for various chronic pain conditions, over-the-counter pills might not be enough. Prescription pills like gabapentin or even opioids like oxycodone may be required. Which one is right for you? Dr. Narang says that pills are typically preferred for acute pain, requiring rapid relief, but both pills and patches work for chronic pain. The ones we prescribe or recommend depend on your needs, and in some cases we'll advise patients to use a combination approach of both patches and pills, he says. Creams or ointments you rub on your skin are another option, which we will discuss at length in a future article. Another important consideration is medication risk. For example, regular, long-term use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can irritate the stomach lining and cause ulcers or stomach bleeding. Even short-term use of NSAIDs slightly increases the risk for heart attack and stroke. And opioids can be addicting and even life-threatening if you take too many. So talk to your doctor before trying something new, even if it's just an over-the-counter pain pill or patch you see in the drugstore. It might have a risk you don't know about. And if you ever experience sudden extreme pain, such as the sudden onset of the worst headache of your life or sudden chest or abdominal pain, don't diagnose yourself. Call 911. Or your doctor. And the article goes on to point out that there are some common pain patches. One type contains menthol, 4% lidocaine, or capsaicin, and is sold over the counter. These are typically used for muscle soreness or mild joint pain. There are also 5% lidocaine patches for prescription for localized pain, like minor injuries or long-lasting nerve pain from shingles. Now, briefly, here's some short articles, again from the Harvard Health Letter of April. And the first one says, morning coffee habit is linked to longer life. Are you an all-day coffee drinker or a morning cup of joe kind of person? The timing of your Java fix might affect your longevity, according to a study in the Europe Heart Journal. Scientists at Harvard and other institutions evaluated the health and reported dietary habits of more than 40,000 adults in the United States who were followed for about a decade. Researchers found two distinct patterns, either morning or all-day coffee drinking. Compared with people who didn't drink any coffee, those who drank it in the morning were 16% less likely to die for any reason during the study period and 31% less likely to die from cardiovascular disease. The greatest benefit came from consuming at least two cups. There weren't any risk reductions among those who drank coffee throughout the day compared with those who didn't drink coffee. The study was observational and doesn't prove conclusively that morning coffee drinking pattern has more health benefits than the all-day habit. But authors speculate that anti-inflammatory chemicals in coffee might be most beneficial in a concentrated amount in the morning, when inflammation levels are typically highest, rather than smaller amounts spread throughout the day as inflammation levels fall. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.